My name is Paul, and I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Paul.
And I see this a Halloween dance, so I kind of looked through my closet to see what I had, you know, put on some kind of outfit, and I decided to come basically as an overweight, middle-aged white guy. And I think I'm pulling it off today. So I feel like I pulled it off, you know. My story is obviously my story, and you know, I understand singleness of purpose, and I'll keep it that way, but there are outside issues in my story, and so it's not everybody's story, but that's okay. You know, one of the early memories that I had was feeling like I was retarded, and I felt like I was like slightly retarded, just under the line, you know, and so actually the reason I bring that up is one of my earliest memories. That's actually how I felt for a lot of years. I kind of felt never good enough. Like I just couldn't do things right like everybody else could. I couldn't read very well. I couldn't write very well. And that haunted me for a long period of time. One of the other early memories I have is, and it's kind of apropos tonight, is when I was real young, there was a program on television that I was forbidden to watch, and it was Dark Shadows. And so I used to go over to a friend of mine's house, and I would sneak over there around 3:30, and we'd watch Dark Shadows. And I remember we were downstairs in his basement. I was probably about seven or eight, and they had this neat little cabinet over in the corner, and they had all these little bitty glasses and all kinds of different colored drinks. And there was one that really caught my attention because it was a really bright green drink. And in this special, you could tell it was a special type of bottle. Later I realized it was a decanter. So I decided to take one of those little bitty, neat little bitty glasses and pour myself a drink. And so I did. And I tasted it, and it was nasty. And I thought, oh, my God, that's the nastiest stuff I've ever tasted. And then the next thing I knew, I drank some more. And I realized one thing. It actually made me feel a little different. It was warm. Not much of a difference, but it was just warm. And somehow I just thought that was the coolest thing in the world. So that's kind of, I guess that would be like my first drink, you know. I'm eventually going to get to the point where that's going to be my final drink, because as I get some more sobriety, I'm starting to age with that. So I'm going to kind of start going backwards, you know. Anyway, people who've got that, they'll understand. But at any rate, one of the things that I began to understand more and more was that that I really was different than a lot of people that I was around. There was two things that was very different. I was very good at athletics, and they found out that I was dyslexic. And so that was a relief, because all of a sudden, maybe, just maybe, I wasn't retarded. Maybe I had a shot at this. And that began to give me some confidence that I didn't have before. So one of the things that that they introduced me to was I was one of the early Ritalin kids, like one of the first ones. And back then, it was a little different. They used it for everything. But all I know is I took some. I didn't need to sleep for about 3 days, and I caught up with all my homework and was like doing work in the future. And I thought, I have arrived. Well, during that process, I went to a school that was had a large Jewish population. So a lot of my friends would, you know, were going through bar mitzvahs. Part of that bar mitzvah is we get to learn a new word, manischewitz, right? So I would go, you know, around 12. And I started realizing, and the parents were kind of cool with it as long as we stayed, you know, there. And everything was great. And I started realizing I felt like I could do anything. I felt okay. I felt just like I was as good as anybody else. And then I started finding out other things. I started finding out that there was alcohol and all kinds of things. So, you know, for a while, my drink of choice was, you know, Nyquil or Vicks, back when Vicks actually had booze in it, you know. And I remember drinking one night in the back of my parents' car. I must have been about 13 or 14 years old. And they and my parents were going at it. And I think I was about the end of that bottle. And I remember I looked and I told my dad, I was like, why don't you just tell the bitch to shut up? I learned two things very clearly. Alcohol will make you say anything, and your father's arm can grow an additional 10 or 11 inches if that's what it takes to get you. And it seemed like alcohol began to cause me a lot of problems, mainly because I was kind of willing to do whatever to get it. I came from a fairly my family didn't have a problem with money, and so I started learning how to scam the credit card deal, get my parents' credit cards, you know, fill up somebody's tank of gas for, you know, a case of beer, all that kind of stuff. I mean, that was the old school way of doing it when you're underage. And, you know, people would always be like, what do you like to drink? It's like, what do you got? You know, I'm not real picky when you kind of got to get whatever you can get. The drinking age in Georgia at that time was 18. And I had a full beard when I was 15. So that helped tremendously. I was able to buy it. And you know, nobody really checked back then. It was just kind of like you flash your ID and move on. But I guess I was about 14 years old, and I went to a buddy of mine's house. And I'd forgotten about this till just the other day. I saw him on Facebook, and it reminded me. But at any rate, we were hanging out. It was about 11:30 at night. His mother had already passed out. And we decided that we were going to go get some beer. And so we got his mother's Mercedes, and we cruised on over to Roswell Road, and used to be a drive-through liquor store right there, and right there on West Wyuka and Roswell Road. So we just whipped right up in there, ordered it, they threw it in the back, handed the cash, cruised on, started drinking. Somehow, you know, my driving ability probably sucked anyways at that age, but especially when I'd had a few. And we ended up running up an embankment, and it was rainy that night, and got stuck in the mud. So we left, obviously. Anyway, long story short, I remember thinking, already scheming at that age, on how to get the keys back in. And I remember we took the keys. I'm like, no, just throw the keys outside the door and everything. And of course, the next morning, the police were there, and we had busted the door, because it's where the keys were, right next to it. So it would look like somebody broke in, took the keys, and drove the car off. It worked. And that got me thinking, I can get away with a whole lot of stuff, you know. And that set a real pattern for me, and that's kind of the way that my life began. I ended up, my parents thought, you know what, you need some good hard work, and so they sent me to Clewiston, Florida, which is right left of the armpit of Florida, right? And we were on Lake Okeechobee. So anyway, I went to go live with my uncle so I could do some hard work at about 16. And went down there, and the only hard work I really found was that we broke at about 2 o'clock every afternoon, started drinking beer. And so we would do that, and then we would go to the bars. And he loved to tell people I was like 13 or 14 years old, and I could outdrink them, and that would be the big thing. And so I would. So all of a sudden, I started taking pride in how much I could drink and that kind of thing. And it was a ton. In the process of all that, I'm still on Ritalin, and back then the scripts were a little different than they were now. They were a little more open, so I was always losing my bottles. Bottom line is I was doing about 150 milligrams a day, and at times, which is nuts. That's like enough to kill you. But it kept me drinking, and at any rate, I ended up having to go meet my parents because things were not good. I ended up getting arrested. Which was kind of cool because my uncle was the mayor, so I, you know, kind of went through the system. They thought it would be real funny when I was blacked out one night for me to get married, so they got JP and did that, took me about 2 weeks to get it annulled because I didn't know the lady's name. Patterns in my life, and as I'll go into in a minute. But at any rate, there was a lot that went on during that period of time and a lot of craziness. I started working in restaurants at that period of time because one of the big things was I could go in the coolers and there was beer. I could drink beer. I could drink whatever. We'd always get a bottle at night, take it out after work and drink. The biggest thing I learned to do during that period of time was take a couple beers and stick them up underneath my seat. Because when I would get up to go to school the next day, I was shaking. And I learned that a little beer helps, you know? And so I did that. So at any rate, I started needing to drink during the day. And so I would carry a Sprite bottle with me. We all know what's in the Sprite bottle, you know? It isn't always Sprite. And I'd get pretty toasted. Or I would maintain, I guess, more than anything else. But at any rate, we all have these lines that we won't cross, you know? And one of mine was I just always had a heart for people that couldn't take care of themselves. And I had a guy that I would take to school every morning. Well, he was not all mentally there. And he went in to tell one of the counselors that he was scared sometimes when he was riding with me because he saw me take another bottle and put it into that bottle. And he was, like I say, he was mentally deficient. So they called me in and I got out of that. But when I saw him, I beat the hell out of him. And that really crossed the line for me. And I realized that this thing was bigger than I was. I wanted to stop drinking then, but I didn't know how, you know. And I was a buddy of mine had gone to rehab. And back then, adolescent rehab, man, it was sometimes 6 months, 9 months. It was nuts. So he'd been gone almost 9 months. And he was coming in, or he was getting out, and I thought, okay, great. This guy's going to help me out. I mean, if anybody can tell me how to stop drinking, this guy can. Because he's learned how to, or at least he's learned how maybe to drink. I don't know. So I picked him up because we were going to go on a church retreat. And I thought, great. So I cleaned my car out. I got rid of everything. I picked the guy up. We're about halfway up to this mountain resort that we were having at it. He said, dude, I got something for you. And it was a bottle of vodka. And it was, and I remember my heart just sunk. You know, well, we did what we do, you know, I drank, but it was different this time. I ingested a lot more alcohol than I ever had at one given period of time. And we were out and it was freezing cold. And I was just like, I was taking my shirt off and just laying down in the grass because I was so hot. I couldn't get rid of it. And my skin was itching and it was different than it had ever been. And, so I ate a bunch of Ritalin because I'm thinking, okay, somehow that's going to work. It was the craziest thing I ever did. Then I blacked out. But at any rate, I said, we got to go. But the big thing I remember before I blacked out was I kept throwing the freaking bottle in the bushes and saying, dear God, help me. I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. And then I'd be there, like, looking for it. And I'd find it, and I'd hit it again. And I'd throw it, and I'd be like, dear God, please help me. And I finally, when it was empty, I remember throwing it. And I laid there for a while. And that's about the end that I remember. What I found out later was when I was walking back to where we were going and I was like all over the place. They were trying to help me get back there. I just walked right through somebody's trailer. Walked in their front door. Walked right out their back door. So when you do that, some people call 911. And they did. I got to detox, and it was, I needed to be there. It was very dangerous. It was not a good situation. That was September 14th, 1980, and that's when I got sober. And that would probably end a lot of people's story. Mine maybe is a little different than some in that, you know, I was, I was graduating high school. I mean, I was that young. So I still had to go through a whole lot of life, you know. The irony to it is the people I got sober with, you know, at the We Had Enough group, okay, that was the We Had Enough young people's group. We just dropped the young people as of about a year ago. I don't know. You know, we had a group conscious and realized that the average age at that point, at this point in time, is about 48. So, you know, it was time to move on. But I went and I watched a movie. Everybody remember when TBS used to have, like, whatever movie they showed in the morning, they would show at night. It was usually black and white movies or whatever. I mean, this is long before they were who they are now, TBN. And so there was this old movie called Days of Wine and Roses with Jack Klugman. And I'm watching this thing, right, because I'm like, at the house trying. I'm afraid to go to school. I'm afraid to go to work. I'm afraid to go anywhere because I don't know what to do. I just know that I want to drink, but I don't want to drink. And so I watched that movie, and it kept talking about AA, AA. And so you can imagine now my concept of AA. It's these old people in black and white. And so I didn't care anymore. I just had to get help. And I went in and I, because I tried to kick it for about 2.5 weeks by myself. And and literally one night my dad heard me trying to pry the door off of the liquor cabinet. And I remember I just broke down and I started crying. I was like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And I'd already told my dad that I was alcoholic earlier that day. And I'll never forget it. The man just cried and cried and cried and said, what did I do? And I'm thinking, damn, it's about me, not about you. But that's okay. So my mom, being a great psychologist, and she really is, asked me how I feel. You know, how do you feel about that? And I felt fine, right? We all know what fine is, correct? Freaked out, insecure, neurotic, then emotional. And I just needed help. So I went ahead and I called up the... called up central office and said, listen, I just want to find out where one of these AA meetings are. And I guess the lady could tell I was young because she sent me to a Friday night meeting over at Peaceford Hospital that had about 80 young people in it under the age of 25. And I remember I was always thinking to myself, I wonder how bad I need this. And the one thing I always knew is I was thinking to myself, you know what? I had this one buddy of mine, and he was bad. I mean, you're talking about bad. He was bad. And I thought to myself, if I ever get to that point, I'm going to put a freaking gun to my head or go to one of these rehabs or something. So I walk into the meeting, and I'm already nervous. And, you know, we all remember how much we remember at the first meeting, right? Zero. So I'm standing there freaking out, wondering, what's in the freaking coffee? Because obviously these people are a little too happy, you know. And this dude grabs me and spins me around, and I'm like, I'm about to take this guy out, okay? Because I played football and everything. I was, anyway, long story short, I'm looking at the guy, and he looks at me, and it's Jack. And it's the guy who I always thought that. He said, dude, I'm so glad to see you here. When I realized it was getting as bad as you, I knew I had to do something. So reality was kind of catching up with me real quick. When I first got here, I'd been here about, oh man, I guess a week and a half, and I met a girl. And, yeah, and I met a girl, and her name was Andrea, and I just thought she was the greatest thing in the world, and then she told me she had like 9 months. And I was like, off of what? Because nobody can, you know, you mean you just drink occasionally, right? She's like, no, 9 months. And I thought, wow. So I was going to ask her out, and I asked her out, and she asked me one question right back. She said, who's your sponsor? And I said, he is. She said, great. She goes, he's a good guy. I said, yes, he is. Right after the meeting, I went up to him. I said, I don't know what this sponsorship thing's about, but I think you're my sponsor. And so he did. He sponsored me for a long time, and it was great. And one of the things he said, well, that's, you know, here's the first thing I'm going to teach you as your sponsor. I said, great. What? He goes, this is how you pick up ashtrays. So I picked up ashtrays, and then I started cleaning them. And then somebody else was starting to pick up the ashtrays. And I'm like, hey, dude, they're ashtrays. They're mine. And they said, no, you're going to coffee next. After you learn how to wash coffee cups, you know. This is like the only clubhouse I know that's still, this and Rebus, that still uses real, you know, coffee cups. But that was huge for me because it gave me a sense of where I needed to be and what I needed to do. Well, at any rate, during that process, my girlfriend there became my baby mama. And that was not real popular at the time. You know, what you would do then is you would go off to boarding school. And so she went off to boarding school and I went off to Auburn University. And I knew that I needed help at Auburn. And, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, you go into college, you don't want to drink, you got about a year of sobriety. That's not a real healthy situation. So I went to one of the deans, the dean of men, and said, I'm interested in where I can find some AA meetings. He goes, I don't know anything about that. He says, we don't have a problem here at Auburn University with alcohol. And I remember looking at him, I said, you know, I realize that. I've never seen it so easy to get in my life. And he didn't appreciate it. Because at that time, they had moved the drinking age up now to 21. So I would actually drive back to Atlanta 3 days a week. Now, I'd like to say that's because there was no meetings down there. There actually was. And one meeting told me I was too young, flat out, and I just couldn't. I didn't qualify. Don't know what that means, but I didn't qualify. The other people, they had an issue because, I don't know, I kind of like to use some language that wasn't, you know. And they were old. I'm not talking because I was 18 and they were old. I'm talking about they were old, okay? And finally, they said, you got to leave for a little while. So I left. I came back. And they told me that that they had a couple other young people, too. And I said, really? This is great. I mean, you know, this is a good thing. And so they introduced me. They said, and they both go to Auburn. I said, fantastic. One of them was getting her PhD. I think she was 33. And she was the next youngest person. And then there was this other guy that had just come out of a rehab. And he was, I think, 31 and going back to college. So I felt kind of in a weird position. So what I did do is I actually found a couple other people, and we started a meeting in Auburn. The cool thing is that was three of us. Today, that meeting is still down there with over 90 people, they say, consistently. So you never know what's going to happen when you just do the next right thing. So anyway, I remember I came up to my sponsor in Atlanta, and I said, they're screwed up down there. I think we need to call AA and report them because they won't let me go to meetings. And he said, yeah, right. So we got some reality checks there. Well, I started going back down there, and there's a clubhouse in Opelika, and right in front of the clubhouse there is a Jiffy Mart kind of thing or whatever. And so I went in, I saw it, and I went in to get some cigarettes. And I looked over, and I saw the, like, all I can say is there was a girl. And she had the most beautiful blue eyes I had ever seen in my life. And I went up, and I told her that. And I said, they're stunning. And didn't say any more. She said, well, I got to go. I have somewhere to be. I said, okay, whatever. So she did. Well, so I go to the meeting, and I sit down, and what's sitting right across from me? Blue eyes, right? So, and I knew I was in love right then and there. And matter of fact, my divorce papers proved that. So we were going to get married. And in great alcoholic. Now, here's the cool thing. See, it made a lot of sense to me. It was God, because while I was there, my car got stolen. Literally, that night. She had had two DUIs. And she had a new car. I got a license. She's got a car. It's marriage made in heaven. So that was the way it really went. And so we were. I was picking her up. That lasted about, 4 days. And then I decided she needed to move in, and she agreed. So she moved in. And yeah, kind of nuts, huh? So we went down, we were going to get married, and we went down to get our marriage license, and that's when she found out I was 19 years old. She was 24. She had a little issue with that, not much, but it was a little thing. So you'd think maybe that was a big enough issue to, no, we're going to do it anyways. So I had her call my parents up and tell them we were getting married and introduce herself. That went over real well. So they my parents got kind of smart. You know, my mother's a psychologist. She thought this out. She said, only thing I'm going to ask you is just get married in a church. Because she figured I'd buy her some time. So in good codependent alcoholic fashion, I said, okay, I rented the largest church, First Baptist Church, on a Monday. Got it really cheap. We went and got our blood. And, see, the thing is, in Alabama, you can get married the day after you get your blood test, but it doesn't come back for 3 days. In Georgia, you can't get married for 3 days, but you can get your blood test back in the same day. So we went to Columbus, got our blood test, and came on back, right? Because I'm going to manipulate the system again. So the night before we get married, I'm on the phone with baby mama. So this is how quick this is, right? Going to asking her, can we work this out? I'll leave right now. Come back to Atlanta. And we'll be happy. And in her great wisdom, Andrea said one thing. I'll never forget it. She said, if you can keep us in the lifestyle that we're both Dunwoody darlings, if you can keep us in that same lifestyle, I'll be back tomorrow. And I knew I couldn't. So I married my ex-wife the next morning. Because that one didn't work out, so this is the one I must, you know, I'm supposed to be at. That's the mentality that I was at that point in time. So just because the alcohol was out didn't mean that my sober thinking was in. And the cool thing was is she stayed sober for about 6 minutes after we got married, and not seriously, about 6 months, and started drinking again. So for the first time in my life, I found out what it was like to be on the other end. Well, I was embarrassed. I didn't want to go to meetings. I didn't want to do that kind of thing. And so I started slacking off of meetings. Eventually, we got divorced. And I started to, I became real big about just wanting to make money. So my dad, I never could measure up to what my dad wanted me to measure up to. And my dad had done very well. Well, my father's company went public. Doesn't mean anything except for this. I wanted to go in and buy enough shares so that I could have control, just a little control, voting control, so I could go in and fire him, then he would respect me. Crazy thinking, but it's thoughts of an alcoholic. So I went on this quest to make as much money as I could. And one of the cool things is when you do that, sometimes morals and stuff just go right out the window because that's not important anymore. And long, basically, what I started doing is I worked with people. Remember, y'all remember the Toyota tent sales? Mm-hmm. Well, I was with the group that would do those all over the Southeast, and we had a whole thing, and I won't go into it because it's pretty messed up. But we had a whole deal worked out. Well, during that time, we had a dealership in Mobile. Oh, I forgot to tell you this: when I was coming back after my little experience in Clewiston, my parents told me to meet them in Mobile, Alabama, fly into there because we were going to go on vacation there. And I flew in there, and we were driving through the town, and I'm looking around going, this has got to be the butthole of America. I would never live here ever. 6 years later, I'm living there. But so I'm in Mobile, and we had a dealership. It was myself and two other guys. And so one of the things that we would do is, when we were at the Toyota tent sales, we would buy up all the used cars. And so we had a really nice inventory. And other people found out it. So we needed money. And so we borrowed money from a group in Chicago. Easiest money I ever got in my life. They didn't ask any questions. They only asked us to do one thing. Make sure that we bought cars, transferred them in from Miami, transferred them into us, got new titles, and sent titles. No problem. We started making money on top of money on top of money. I mean, I'd never made money like this in my life. And I'm 24 years old at the time, you know, and we're making, I mean, huge amounts and literally can't spend it fast enough. And they were happy as could be. Well, in that process, one day I got a title and I noticed it was the car had been totaled. So I called up and I'm like, look, I don't know what they're trying to do. I think they're trying to scam you. And the guy goes, don't worry about it. Yeah, thanks for letting us know. Just let that one ride through too. So, I didn't know any better. I'm just moving money. And all of a sudden, one day I go to work, and there's a big padlock on my freaking door, and all kinds of stuff, and a bunch of people running around with all kinds of neat little initials on their backs. And one of them I recognized because it said DEA. And I freaked out. And I left. Well, during that process, I had met a girl. And she was the love of my life again. And she was my accountant. And she was good about taking care of stuff. Because one of the things that I'd learned to do is I'd learned how to create. Learned how to create IDs. And I had a lot of different IDs. And a lot of different lines of credit. And a lot of different messed up stuff. Yet, I'm sober. Had a lot of people working for us in the program. Because we were all sober. What I found out later on is I was moving money for a particular family. A large family. And that was in the late 80s. And a particular gentleman got busted. I believe they generally called him the Teflon Don there. And when that happened, a lot of things began. A lot of money places began to break through. I took off that day when I saw all that stuff happening. And I went to my girlfriend, or my whatever, live-in, love of my life. And told her that it was kind of what was going down. I didn't know exactly what was going down. I remember when I pulled up, I lived at the yacht club. And when I pulled up, I'm looking down and I see them pulling my boat. They're pulling it. At the same time, another one's hooking one of my cars and it's going. I'm realizing this is bad. This is really bad. So I go to her and I said, listen, we need money and I know you got it stashed. And she said, yeah, I do. And I said, and she said, we're having problems and I can't deal with this. And I said, okay, here's what you do. I'll pay for you to go live somewhere and I'll go live with John. And I remember she looked at me and she said, John and I don't want you living there. Well, I was out of town all the time, see. And so, which I don't know why, maybe this is, I probably should have thought of this at the time. She'd been treated for drug addiction and sex addiction. I don't know. That kind of, you know, so I just, but she was so in love with me, right? Well, she was right. She moved my money right from my account into her own corporation. So I had nothing. Didn't take but a few hours for everybody to catch up with me. Next thing I know, I'm sitting in this room talking to these guys, and they're asking me all kinds of questions. And one of them asked me about a program that they had, and they were telling me about it. You know, the feds have this interesting program. They will help you relocate. And they'll help you pay the expenses for that. They only ask you to do one thing. Don't tell anybody where you're going. And I remember they asked me, they said, would you have a problem walking away from your family for 5 years? I said, absolutely not. Because I had nothing to do with my family. Because I'm sober. They realized that I didn't know anything. And I really didn't after about 24 hours. But during that period of time, I've lost the girl, I've lost my business, I've lost my home, I've lost everything. So I'm sitting at the mall, because there's only really one big mall in Mobile. And I'm sitting at the mall, and here comes my ex-wife. And I looked at her, and she's a doctor, and I looked at her and I said, are you about ready to go home? And she knew something wasn't right. And she said, sure. Let's go. And I said, you know, I don't remember where we parked the car. She said, it's okay. I've got the keys. I said, okay. So she took me, and she ended up taking me to go get help because I had totally lost it. I just had totally lost it. And so I ended up in a psych unit outside of Mobile, and about 35 miles outside of Mobile. And I went in there, and they couldn't put me in for psych. So they said, the guy recognized me from the program. He goes, well, you're an alcoholic. And I go, yeah. He said, well, why don't you just go drink a beer, come back, and everything will be all right. And I remember looking at him, and I said, you know what? I've been a liar, a cheat, and a thief most of my life. There's one thing I'm not going to do. I am not going to drink. I said, if I leave here, I'll probably blow my brains out, but I am not going to freaking do that. And he said, blew my mind too. At any rate, I said, why don't we just lie about it? We'll just, I'll just say, yeah, I got drunk or whatever. I'll say anything. And he said that won't work. But anyway, they did a psych eval and they brought me in. Well, during that process, they had at that time this new term had come out, and I won't go into it a lot, but it was a term known as codependency. And so I'm sitting there like, yeah, man, I'm addicted to another human being. You know, ooh, you know, I mean, I would. I'd stand there and go, I'm just like addicted to everybody. So I'm sitting there, and I start thinking to myself, I just got to find the love of my life again. It'll all be okay, right? It'll be okay. So I literally get on my knees, and I said, dear God, please help me see Paula just one more time, and so I can tell her I love her, and everything will be okay. And I get up. Now, they got me on the detox unit. What I realized later, a few days later, is they really were watching after me for suicide watch. But anyway, they were trying to be decent about it. So because I was sober, they gave me a little flexibility, and I walked outside, and I was standing at the nurse's station, and 35 miles away, guess who comes walking down the hallway? Paula. Because she got my money, and she's going to move. So I forgot that's where she went to go to treatment. She was coming by to pick up her paperwork. And I literally got physically ill. I mean, physically ill. Ran back in and just puked my brains out. And I realized something. Maybe some truth in this. So I'm sitting there in treatment, and I'm sure no one else has ever had this, a little buyer's remorse. I've been in there about 2 days, and I'm thinking, this is stupid, and I have screwed up. So this other guy looks at me, he says, let me ask you a question. I said, yeah. He goes, I noticed where you had worked and a couple of your friends have all been on TV for the past few days. I said, well, yeah. He said, did y'all kill anybody? I said, no. He said, you kidnap anybody? No. He said, well, you know, if you stay here, we can't tell anybody you're here. So if you need a place to kind of lay low for a little bit, this would be a great place. I said, dude, you're on my... We're thinking the same way now. I'm like, I like you, you know? And I'd never gone to treatment, so I'm going, great. And they said, so we're going to do, you know, we're going to do some little activities with you and stuff. I said, fantastic. So the next morning, they tell me that I can move into on a unit. I said, great. And they said, yeah, we think you'd best be served on the A&D unit. And I said, sure, no problem. Now, I used to work as a tech in a treatment facility before that. And I remember I looked at them, I said, A&D, is that a new term? It used to mean alcohol and drugs. They said, yeah, that's where we think you'd best be served. I said, no, you don't understand. I told my story here about 8 months ago, so I can't be on the A&D unit, you know. And then the guy... Smart, this guy way outsmarted me. He looked at me and he said, would you rather be on the psych unit? You know what's over there? And I'm like, yeah. I had no clue, nor was he telling me. He just knew how I was. He said, just try it. Point is, it changed my life. So I picked up my 7-year chip in treatment. A little unusual. But it changed my life because all of a sudden, all the crap I had done, everything that I'd been involved in, my whole life had changed, and I was left with nothing, zero. And I'm sitting there in that treatment center, and I got down on my knees again, and I said, okay, God, it's your turn. I've done all I'm supposed to do, and I can't do it. So it has to be you, not me. And I remember standing up and thinking I just had a peace. It was just some kind of peace about what I had just done. And the other great thing was, of course, they had family week. I remember I hadn't talked to my parents in 2 years. I'm sitting there on the phone trying to explain to them why I'm in a treatment center and why I need them to come to Mobile, Alabama, or where I was. And they agreed. And the interesting thing was, I couldn't stand my mother. I had an issue with her. I just couldn't stand her because it was like my whole life, all that ever happened was I was heavily abused as a kid. And what would end up happening was she would end up always threatening me with my father. And then my father was out of town for the whole week. So he'd come home, and guess what the first thing was? Get the hell beat out of me. So I just couldn't stand her. I hated her. The interesting thing is, my father actually called me when I was living in Auburn, called me up, and asked me to meet my mother and himself at Callaway Gardens. I was like, it ain't happening. Because I didn't trust him. I knew somehow I was in trouble. So anyway, I went and I did see him. I said, okay, I'll have dinner with you, but because they wanted me to spend the weekend. I said, I'll have dinner with you. That's it. I went and had dinner. I remember after dinner, my dad took me back to the hotel room, and he said, son, I made a lot of mistakes in my life. And he said, the biggest one is the way I treated you. And I am sorry for everything I ever did to you. And so in good alcoholic type behavior, I looked at him and said, F you, you son of a bitch. And walked off. And that's why I didn't talk to my parents for years after that. So anyway, long story short, they came for family week. It was great. Because what I saw for the first time is I watched, they kept trying to work with this other family member. I mean, I'm talking about that I was in group with. And nobody could get through with them. And I actually watched my mom do what she does best. And she did it. And they broke through a bunch of stuff that they had never broke through before. So I got to see her actually do what she does. And it changed my life, changed my heart towards her. Because I wanted to do whatever God wanted me to do with that. Well, God's done a lot in my life since then. And one of the biggest things that that he's done is he's enabled me to have things I never thought I would have. You know, because of deciding to do this program right. I never had the money I had then, but what money was it? Because it was temporary. But God showed me that the way that he wants things done is a way that he wants to provide for me for the rest of my life. Because he's really out for my good, not for my bad. And so the bottom line to that is you know, I'm getting ready. I'm a chef by trade, and I'm getting ready to compete again on at the World Food Championships. So I'll be rated again, and that's something I never thought would happen, never. You know, and I've watched that happen. I ended up getting married again, and have three kids that have never seen me intoxicated, never seen me use. The child that we had when I was first came in, it was an open adoption. I found out 16 years later I was not the father. And believe it or not, that was hard. And God kept me, helped me through that, you know. Another big thing that he's done is he's given me a network of people in this program. I mean, I've got friends that we had enough. My sponsor, I've known her since I came in, you know. And I've had the same friends for 34 years, 35 years, about to be 36 years next month. And God has just continually blessed me and blessed me and blessed me, you know. And if there's nothing else, I'm grateful I'm here today because I'm probably saving a seat for one of my kids. You know, I got one that probably needs to be here, you know. But I'm living a life that he sees what it's like to be sober, you know. And it's funny, the other day he looked at me and said, Dad. Because I said, he kind of pissed me off. And I said, son, you know, there's a problem here when we're having lunch, and your liquor bill's higher than our food bill. Mm-hmm. And he goes, well, Dad, come on. You know what it's like to be 21 and you know. And he said, I said, yeah, I know what it's like to be 21. He says, well, you know how it is when you're 21? I said, yeah, let's see. I had a mortgage, a marriage, and I was 3 years sober. So, yeah, I understand real well what it's like. He was like, well, okay, I'm pretty much there. I go, well, you're not married, you're not sober, and, you know, what are you talking about? He's like, well, I mean, I'm just asking you to pay for a few things. I said, I'm not going to do it. And he looks at me and he goes, well, didn't Mama and Papa pay for everything for you when you were my age? I mean, didn't they take care of your cell phone? I'm like, I'm thinking this kid was in the gifted program. I'm like, no, they didn't even pay for the twigs to put up the smoke signals, you know. So I'm grateful today that God is in my life and that my kids, regardless of how I feel about that one, we have a relationship, and I have a good relationship with my kids. And even the one that tells me he hates me, we're going through that stage. Whatever, you know, and that's the cool thing. I can look at him and go, whatever, you know, because I was 18 too at one time, you know, and that's the amazing thing. And it's good to be here, and I appreciate you guys letting me come and talk, because it reminds me of where I came from You know, I think sometimes we kind of forget, you know. And I don't want to forget, nor do I want to forget the blessings that God has given me today. So thank you.